You're listening to the Monocle Weekly, first broadcast on the 17th of November 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 228 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck.
On today's show, we'll be looking back at the history of the world using only 100 recipes. Author and chef William Sitwell joins us in the studio.
Also ahead, the use of numbers has played a role in our lives for thousands of years, but a new book reveals the rather magical and mystical way they've influenced everything from religion to poetry.
Plus, for all of you redheads listening out there, don't worry, no gags coming up. We're going to help rebrand the lot of you as Red Hot, along with the new photography exhibition.
That is all to come. Plus, Daniel Giacopelli will be here with next week's news look ahead. And we'll be selecting some great music for you too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Another day, another dollar, another week ticks by, Andrew. How will you remember this past week?
Well, first of all, I'm surprised to see you here because you claimed last week you wouldn't be here this week.
I know. I like to leave people on edge and then surprise them at the last minute.
That's because Mr. Robert Bound has headed off to Jumex, as you say it, the new Mexican art gallery space.
Exciting.
I haven't heard a thing from him all week.
No, neither. Me neither. But I gather he's probably doing very, very important work there.
I think he's doing very important work. I'm not sure what her name is, but he's doing very important work. Now, it does say at the top of the show, no gags about redheads.
Absolutely. I'm willing to try and live up to that, promise.
Okay. So we can't say anything about Allard John?
Strawberry blonde Allard John, do you mean?
I know, he's slightly rebranded himself, hasn't he? Anyway.
You've got to be ambitious when it comes to a rebrand.
No, we have an interesting guest coming on who's a pro redhead, partly redhead, I believe, himself, in the beardy department.
He is, yeah, red beard. So, Barbarossa, I believe, is the translation for that.
You call him Barbara? How intimately do you know him?
Yes, let's not get into that right now. It's interesting though, isn't it, Andrew? You don't want to sort of insult people because I know you've had an interesting week.
Why?
It's best not to.
Okay.
Because you don't want to incur the displeasure of, for example, you know, the sort of supreme leader of a fairly intolerant Middle Eastern country, for example, by insulting him live on the radio.
Well, our next guest did lead me in a script this week into a kind of a dangerous corner, which we won't go over again, with a very unwise choice of songs. And then I got carried away. And then you said something even worse, but thank God you weren't on air.
Exactly. That's the time to make the gags, Andrew, okay. You see? There's safety in silence.
Let's just say your title for a song was It's Iranian Men.
Come on, that's pretty good.
Okay. I'm going to leave us all standing safely. What should we do next?
Well, yeah, let's... you mentioned this producer who'd badly let you down as so often this week. Why don't we hear from him right now to look ahead at next week's news today? I could only be talking about Daniel Giacopelli. It is indeed time to look ahead at the week ahead of us here on the Monocle Weekly. And because I'm on this side of the microphone for once, it's Daniel Giacopelli's turn again. Danny, welcome back.
Can I just say, I think it's fairly a good possibility that there's a fatwa on Andrew's head.
And not only from the staff.
Yes, I'm here. Time for my weekly news look ahead, as you said.
And you've printed out things. We've got paper clips.
I do my
homework.
We've
got staples.
I'm pretty impressed by that.
Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, Andrew. So today, the Dubai Air Show kicks off, which is probably fairly moderately interesting for our listeners because it's one of the biggest aviation events of the year. It's, in fact, one of the largest ones ever. It's a five-day show, kicks off today. It's held for the first time in the new airport there, $32 million Al Maktoum Airport. This show is supposed to be the best one, the most popular one in the history of the show.
Intriguing. And air shows, there always seems to be big orders placed, or certainly the announcement of big orders placed. So I'll be intrigued to see who's spending and which are the big airframe makers that are going to be punching the air in delight at some huge new orders.
I see they're saying that part of the reason for this kind of migration of these shows to the region is off the strength of the local airlines who are kind of buying up so many planes. And there's a quote here saying, the days of Farnborough are gone. I don't think that's true.
Well, Tristan McAllister, our transport editor, would probably have something to say about that.
He would. And I imagine, Andrew, that we'll be hearing from him about this.
It's amazing, though.
In the next few days.
It's amazing how much, how many, you know, the quantity of planes bought. I mean, in 2007, $155 billion worth of deals took place. That's a staggering amount, Tom.
And I like it is staggering. It is certainly.
I always like the choreography, the connivance of choreography that happens at these events, where they always announce these big deals on the first day, which have been, you know, kind of known about for weeks and weeks and weeks, but they just only kind of reveal them all on the big day to make them all look nice and exciting.
Well, you got to do these things with the right amount of fanfare, and they'll certainly do things in style, I imagine. Over in Dubai.
So on Tuesday, we're heading to the U.S. where former President George W. Bush will be on The Tonight Show. It's going to be the fourth time he's been on the show since 2000, which is when he first appeared. And, you know, what's interesting is that he's kind of gone off the radar since he stopped being president. He moved back to Texas. We really haven't heard much from him.
He's been doing his paintings.
Yeah, we've all seen.
Is this a good idea? Because it's interesting, if you look at his actual numbers when they ask people in polls, you know, he's quite substantially more popular now than he was even at the height of his spells in office, which is interesting, given, as you say, he's had such a low profile. Do you think it's this old thing we've seen before about presidents? It's that old familiarity, the fact that he's not been around for a while doesn't change anything. People just always look back in America with fondness at their former presidents.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost a law in American politics that once you stop being president, you immediately, or at least after a few years, start becoming more popular.
And also his jokes seem almost funny now he's not in office. When he's in office, it was a bit worrying.
Right. With his finger hovering above the button. Yeah.
That's the thing with him. I mean, everybody said, you know, they would think he's the president they'd want to get a beer with. They'd want to hang out with him. They wouldn't want to hang out with Obama. They trust him maybe more as a leader, but they... not as a friend. And, you know, now that he's not president anymore, he's kind of...
And do you think Jay Leno will be friendly with him? Or do you think there might be a few barbed... Will they be mean about his art? Because it's, you know, it's not terrific, is it, some of his paintings? Or do you think it'll
be
fairly good?
I disagree.
Humored?
I think the paintings are quite good. In case our listeners don't know, so he paints he paints a hacker hacked into his email account and leaked all of these paintings that he had, which were private. I mean, nobody knew they existed. Nobody really knew he painted. They're pictures mostly, as you say, of his dogs, of landscapes. And now, actually, he said he's going to start painting, I think it's 19 world leaders that he met in his time in office.
That I want to see.
Yeah, that would be very good.
Yeah. I mean, you could say it's kind of outsider art, kind of, but I guess that's maybe a bit of a slight.
Art. Not sure. Art, perhaps, yes.
Where do we go now? Wednesday, world powers and Iran meet to discuss, once again, the nuclear deal, the P5+1. And also, actually, on the same day, Netanyahu is meeting with Putin, who, as we all know, has voted the most powerful man in the world recently.
Well, I'm sure in that vote, people had no choice but to vote, did they? That was a 99.9% turnout, I'd imagine.
Exactly. And no, exactly. I mean, yeah.
And the pitchfork up your jacksy didn't encourage you too much either.
Well, the fatwas just keep coming in.
I was going to say, world powers
Revolutionary
Iran,
Guards and the KGB.
To me, surely, if they really want to broker a deal, they should get Andrew Tuck over there. We know that he'll bring the Iranians on side in a flash.
On the same day, a French-Italian high-speed Alpine rail line is being debated in Rome. It would be in the Alps between France and Spain.
That's the nature of Alpine railways.
Very much so, Andrew. A lot of people are saying it's kind of unnecessary and it might hurt the environment, but it sounds kind of cool to me.
Well, they've already got lots of things that go through the Alps, haven't they? Lots of tunnels. They've been digging them for a good 100 years or so. But it does make you think, if they're only just talking about it now...
You suspect that's going to take them a while to bring that to fruition.
Yeah.
I wouldn't get your pickaxes out yet.
Check off the Alpine people for fatwa, too. And also, finally, on Thursday, the future of U.S. troops in Afghanistan will be chatted about in that country by the Loya Jirga, these tribal elders. Because as we all know, after 2014, NATO, for the most part, will be leaving the country. The mission is over, but a small amount of troops will kind of surely still stay there. So they're going to determine, you know, what kind of presence that would be.
And Danny, what happens to you next week? You've been producing Aperitivo for us for the last 10 weeks, and that's season one is over.
Season one of Aperitivo is over, sadly, yeah. So next week, actually, I'll be in Copenhagen for the Creative Business Cup, which is held there by the Danish, kind of the Danish Business Council. They're holding this international entrepreneurship competition. All the finalists from the national winners will go to Copenhagen to compete, and I'll be covering it.
Ooh, look at you.
It'll be fun.
Good.
And then I'll take a little bit of holiday.
I was going to say richly deserved, but I'm not so smart. I'm not going to say that anymore.
I was going to say it myself.
That was Daniel Giacopelli with next week's news today. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We'll be back right after this with a look back at the history of the world told in food. Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck. It may seem like an impossible task, but imagine summing up the history of the world using just food. From ancient Egyptian recipes for unleavened bread to who was the greatest party planner of the Middle Ages, and not to mention a more modern take on food today.
Well, a new book titled A History of the World in 100 Recipes tries to sum up the last few thousand years of mankind using what we used to eat, how we ate it, and perhaps most importantly, how our fascination with food evolved over time. Well, we're delighted to say that we're joined in the studio by the author, William Sitwell.
William, welcome to the programme. I want to start by asking you about the history of food in 100 recipes, because I guess perhaps unusually or counterintuitively for what a recipe book, it's not really designed, I guess, from reading it, for the recipes to actually be prepared. It's recipes as literary things almost. Why did you decide that you wanted to tell this great sort of epic historical story in that way?
Well, you're quite right. And funny enough, when I sign copies of the book, I often say, don't try all the recipes or don't try any of the recipes. Because what I didn't want to do was to present a classic cookbook where all the recipes have been triple tested. The ingredients are available in your local supermarket. You know, this is not a book about functioning recipes. This is a book about how recipes have been portrayed over the years, how they've evolved, where they first appeared, and also how they were written. Because the way that recipes are written over the years and where they appear, I think, is fascinating. And if you try and kind of contemporize everything, you sort of lose the magic in it. So the book starts in the tomb of a woman in ancient Egypt near Luxor. And I had the very specific descriptions of making Egyptian flatbreads sort of decoded by a food editor who I work with. So that's the first recipe. And that's the only one we've actually sort of translated from a wall. You know, throughout time, we kind of start seeing recipes appearing on ancient clay tablets. There's a whole collection of tablets at Yale University, which for years people thought were boring mathematical formulae, until about 10 years ago, someone tried a new translation technique and actually discovered that one of these tablets was a recipe for meat stew from 2,000 years ago. So basically, for me, you know, it's a history of the world through food, and we all eat, we all drink. So it makes history a much more immediate subject, I think, for people. And it's quite a kind of light history as well, as I sort of skip around the world, find the things that just tickle me and the stories that I found fascinating. You know, it's very much prejudiced towards what appeals to me. But it was an amazing experience to write it. I spent, you know, hours in the British Library and trekking, you know, around the world a little bit, sniffing out things, and came across some amazing stories.
Well, I think the first instruction on that ancient Egyptian bread is crush the grain with sticks in a wooden container. There you go. You're already
there. Actually, you could do that recipe. There are recipes that I wouldn't suggest people do, like the meat stew from Mesopotamia 2,500 years ago. But also, I wouldn't suggest you cook Heston Blumenthal's meat fried, which is the final recipe. So there have been recipes printed that you're not supposed to cook right up to the present day that should come with a health warning.
Now, just tell us the history of writing down recipes when they're being recorded all the way back in the times of the ancient Egyptians. Is that because people wanted to record what they were eating? And as it evolves over time, I know that by the time you get to Victorian England, famously, those recipes were being written to instruct women how to run a household. And there's a social history that runs through them as well. What's the evolving...
I think that the most ancient recipes were written down because they must have had some sort of religious significance. Because bear in mind that people were generally illiterate a couple of thousand years ago. So you'd have to employ a scribe. And the recipes from Mesopotamia on the Yale tablets were written in an alphabet called cuneiform, which is a very ancient script. And it would have had some religious significance. And then as we sort of start seeing recipes written down in manuscripts, I mean, the first sort of British manuscript cookbook, if you like, was called Boak of Cokery, which was then ripped off and called This Boak of Cokery in 1500 from 1470. They changed the C to a K. They thought they'd get away with it. That was written down really to sort of, you know, a lot of kings, nobles employed chefs as a way of sort of bigging up. It was a status symbol to have an amazing chef, as it still is today. And so you'd make sure that your chef wrote down his recipes for posterity, and also that you probably put the fear of God into your enemies. You know, these guys could produce a jelly that looked like your castle, and you were the enemy. You thought, my God, they know what my house looks like. They've created a jelly out of it. Mm-hmm. So recipes were used as sort of to terrify people. And then as time went on, they became a little bit more accessible, more useful. And so you get to
until you get to Hester Blumenthal.
Yeah, exactly, where you get a reversal back to sort of, you know, crazy instructional stuff that will kill you. So, you know, Mrs. Beaton's book, actually, I think it's a pretty appalling book. It was a very Victorian book, instructed you not just to make jam roly-poly, but to, you know, go on a course of, you know, dipping yourself into a bath and wake yourself up in the morning. And also, it was, I think, a terrifying thing to have plonked in, you know, as a young bride. You know, you get married, your mother-in-law gives you Mrs. Beaton's complete book of household management, doing, thumps on the desk. That's how you're going to look after my son, young lady. And it tells you everything. Actually, it tells you how to write a will, what duties you should give to your, you know, undermaid, and so on. And actually, what's fascinating about that book is that it developed over time. Mrs. Beaton was, as people know, a 28-year-old girl. She wasn't a sort of haughty Victorian madam. And the book, as it changes, shows the shifts in society as we get rid of our servants. And as we start to take on, you know, but invest in electric cookers, you know, the recipe book changes. So it's quite an interesting book in itself, if you look at all the additions, to show how society develops over time. And then, you know, when you come into the 20th century, you start seeing recipes used as a sort of marketing tool. So the early electric cookers and fridges came with recipe books. Campbell's Soup would publish recipe books in order to get people to try their soups. The recipes are pretty vile. Some of the early chocolate recipes in the kind of 1920s were sent out by chocolate brands who wanted people to go into the early form of supermarket and do shopping. So the reason for writing recipes becomes more and more sophisticated. It's not just about use, it's about brand extensions and so on, all of which we sort of, you know about today. And people are still doing the same thing.
Absolutely. I've still got my copy of the Westinghouse Family Cookbook from its ancient family reason.
Those cookbooks are beautiful because they are wonderful, precious collections that have sort of been inscribed over the years down through the generations.
Well, I want to ask you a bit more about the actual writing about food. I'm going to ask you about actual food criticism in a minute, because I have a couple of specific questions. But in terms of how people write about food, even how recipes are compiled, do you slightly despair? We talked about, you know, the age of illiteracy when people didn't actually understand. In the sort of the new age of illiteracy, if you like, that we may or may not be in, do you think there is a paucity in how people actually construct and write the recipes? They may be very inventive and they may look very beautiful on the page or on the tablet or wherever you're reading them. The actual writing, is it less good than it used to be?
I don't know. You know, you say that, but there was a man called William Kitchener who wrote an amazing book called The Cook's Oracle in about 1913. And in the intro of that book, he lambasts every cookery writer who precedes him and who lives at his time, saying that the recipes don't work, the instructions are too vague. He said that most modern cookbooks would be no more useful for the cook than a sailor would be able to read Robinson Crusoe and sail from England to the Indies. And actually, I started looking back because I thought, hang on a second, every time I get a cookbook from a PR now, it says, at last, the cookbook, the definitive book, the one that worked with simple instructions. And you go back and you look at writers like Hannah Glass in the 18th century, and she was basically saying, here is a simpler, more plainer cookbook than you'll ever see. The first ever printed cookbook from 1500, the introduction reads something like, here beginneth a tale of noble feasts, feast royal, and ye shall find no plainer recipes than in this book. You know, so people have been saying that recipes don't work for years. So I suppose it's my job as a magazine editor to try and make recipes work.
And just on that criticism point, some of our listeners may recognise your voice if they're fans of things like, you know, MasterChef on TV here in the UK, which has various offshoots around the world. A couple of wonderful pithy put-downs. I was watching an episode recently and you took a moment, considered what you'd consumed and just eloquently said, I think that was the most revolting thing I've ever eaten. When you eat a truly awful plate of food, does part of you think, great, I'm going to be really able to put the boot in on this? Is there a sense of relish, even as foul as it might be?
You know, restaurant criticism is a sport, and it's at its most entertaining when it's at its most vicious. It's actually the hardest thing is to write rave reviews about places. And there are people like Adrian Gill and Giles Corran who put the knife in very well. So when I write reviews, I tend to try and be more useful or helpful. On MasterChef, if the food's terrible, we put the knife in. But I remember once when I was starting out doing bits of TV criticism, you know, you'd think of some pithy, brilliant put down and hope that you'd have an opportunity for it. And it doesn't work like that because you sit there desperately trying to come up with this brilliant line. And you have to make it up as you go along and you have to say it as you see it. But, you know, to say something's the most revolting dish I've ever eaten is not like that groundbreaking. I did notice actually at the top of the show, a recent show, they always ask you at the beginning, when we record it. So, you know, what are you looking forward? What are you looking for in a plate of food? And you can, every time we go in, they get the same question. And I don't try to tend to prepare for it, but I did find these words coming out of my mouth that I don't want to be led into a bewildering pasture of filth. And this sort of, and I was watching this show the other day thinking, what are you talking about? You know, and then you go on Twitter and you get these massive amounts of abuse from these people going, God, that guy, you know, the nonsense that comes out of his mouth. You have to see the plate of food, eat it, comment. If you try and be too pretentious, it doesn't work. You've got to keep the comments short. You know, I do it with my friend Jay Rayner, and he prattles on for hours. And you know perfectly well, they only use 4 seconds.
And tell me, if we look at the history of recipes since the Second World War, they also kind of reveal the yearning for kind of social climbing among people, you know, especially in my household, I believe that was true. Many a vol-au-vent was made in the hope that it would turn us into refined people, but never did. Tell me, is that still the case today, that cookbooks are seen as a kind of an entry point into a kind of a more refined world?
Well, certainly. I mean, look, in the digital age, people are worrying about the future of print. Cookbooks are selling better than ever. Yet the statistics are that people are cooking less than they ever have done. So what are people doing? You know, we've got food programming 24 hours a day through every sort of media outlet you can conceive of, but people aren't cooking very much. So what are they doing with these books? Well, they're status symbols, and they still are. And people invest massive amounts of money in cookbooks. I mean, Heston Blumenthal's new historical food book is one of the most beautiful, enormous things I've ever seen. You plonk it on your coffee table. It's a status symbol. People come in and it says a few things about you. And I think that will always be like that. People who have recipe books and own them in the hundreds will probably tell you that they only use about 2 of those books on a regular basis. So I think it's about status. I think, you know, cookery books look beautiful. They feel beautiful. Books like mine, they feel beautiful. It's Wibberlin, by the way, and you can stroke the pig on the cover. So, and this is, I mean, what a status symbol. You know? If I walk into a house and I see that book, it's just weird. I can say, hang on, did you nick my book? It's quite odd.
And tell me, is there a character in here that kind of stood out for you out of those 100 recipes that's just larger than life?
There's a couple of guys. There's Thomas Coriat, who in about 1611 left our shores and went on an adventure around Europe. And he had one morning where he discovered 2 amazing things. First of all, he came across the umbrella. And then he went into a tavern and saw people using a fork. And this had never been seen before. And he came back and he wrote about it. And his friends laughed at him and called him furcifer, which is an old English word for pitchfork. And they said, this will never catch on. The Italians are just effeminate sodomites, one of his contemporaries says. That's why they use forks. We don't need forks. And Thomas Coriat was an extraordinarily brave guy making these amazing expeditions. There's another hero of mine in the book called Clarence Saunders, who basically invented the modern supermarket. He was a very poor American guy in a little town, and he was trying to find a concept because he worked in a grocery store where the economics were always challenging. People in white coats handing you goods from the shelf, rushed off their feet at lunchtime, not enough things to do during the rest of the day. He was on a train back from Indiana. Train slowed down, looked out of the window, and he saw a mother sow feeding her 8 little piglets, and he went, that's it, self-service. And 3 months later, he opened Piggly Wiggly, the world's first supermarket store with aisles and so on. And he went on and to make millions. Piggly Wiggly's still going today. There's about 671 odd stores in the States. But he lost a fortune because traders in New York started to short on his stock, and he tried to buy all his shares back, broke some New York stock exchange rules, and was banned from trading. So he's dusted himself down and opened a new store called Clarence Saunders, sole owner of my name stores, which shows you quite how cross he was. So he's one of my great heroes. So next time you go shopping, think of Clarence Saunders. Next time you use a fork, remember Thomas Coriat.
Absolutely. Just some of the names detailed in History of Food in 100 Recipes by William Sitwell. It's published by Collins. William, thank you very much for coming to Tweaks with us here on the Monocle Weekly.
The Monocle Book Tour has touched down in the warmer parts of the globe, and this November we'll be packing the snowshoes and chilling out in the Nordic region. Starting on November the 18th in Stockholm and taking in a different country each day, we'll be shooting through Oslo and Copenhagen before ending up in Helsinki on the 21st, and we'll be bringing you live shows right here on Monocle 24 from each stop along the way. So if you want to hear how the Monocle Guide to Better Living is going down in the snowier parts of Europe, point your mouse towards book.monocle.com and be sure to tune in to Nordic Leg of the Monocle Book Tour this November on Monocle 24.
Andrew, I'm going to entertain you now, not with a surprise stand-up gig, but with some great music, because we're going to play the new single by Metronomy. This one is called I'm Aquarius. It comes out on the 30th of December.
And that was the new single by Metronomy called I'm Aquarius. It's released on the 30th of December. I'm going to wait, though, Tom. I'm going to wait for I'm Capricorn.
That's a good idea.
What are you?
Pisces, the fish.
Fish. Oh, slippery. Can't quite get hold of you. Flapping around a bit.
I was trying to come back with some kind of quick riposte there. I've got nothing.
No, the Capricorn. Well, actually, the Capricorn's a goat. We're boring, but we're steadfast. We can go round a mountain one little foot at a time.
Very daintily. I must say, I've always had a bit of a sort of love-hate relationship with goats generally.
Why?
Because they're quite aggressive.
Was there an incident?
There's been a few. Okay. I was butted once.
Okay. No horns in this room. Let's move on.
Let's move on the Monocle Weekly with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards. It's time now for us to focus our attention on something that we use every single day in almost every single aspect of our lives. Numbers. From zero to a trillion, mankind has used numbers for thousands, there's another one of them, of years. And in many cases, along with their use has come myths, from why the number 13 is unlucky to why the number 666 is associated with the devil.
Well, a new book hopes to answer some of those questions, along with questions like why Genghis Khan built a city of 108 towers, to how Dante forged his Divine Comedy on the number 11. The book is called Rogerson's Book of Numbers. I'm delighted to say we're joined in the studio by its author, Barnaby Rogerson. Barnaby, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Thanks very much for joining us. Just to start off with, where did your sort of appreciation for numbers and the sort of the science and myths that surround them come from? Because Andrew's right, we use them every day. Sometimes people don't even stop to think, but there's such richness, there's such kind of complexity implicit in them. Where did you get that fascination from, do you think?
Well, my wife warns anybody who's interested in maths to stay away from this book. It's about someone who loves numbers but has pretty patterns and a shape and has tried to sort of tease something out of them. But in a way, the book's quite visual, although it's sort of very textual. It began when I used to work restoring and building grottos, and we were working on this really big thing in Leeds Castle at the centre of a maze and subdividing the dome up into sort of portions. And I had this quite lowly task. I did the sort of pebble floors, but I also had quite a well-read background. And so the workers were sort of asking me, if we do 12, Barnaby, what should we put there? Or if we subdivide that little squinch there with four, what would be appropriate?
And what was the sort of learnings that you used to seize on then? Was it sort of this classic stories, or is it from numbers in Bible and religious texts, or from a hugely wide range of sources?
Well, quite wide-ranging. I mean, the 12 days of Christmas always used to sort of haunt us because it's not always exactly clear what on earth is happening, and some of it's quite Christian. I mean, 7 days of the week has got that sort of mix-up of little bits of Scandinavian gods, the sun and the moon, a little bit of early Christianity. And that's the sort of bubbling confusion that I've delighted in. At the time when I was doing the grotto, I was beginning to write guidebooks. I did about six of those over a decade. And I loved, every summer to combine the sort of stuck in the chair aspect of being a writer with mixing cement and doing something quite sort of physical. But with that came this endless subdivision of my pebble floors and everything. And I started collecting, sort of symbols and numerology around that. I think 12 is one of the most powerful ones. And we all remember the 12 apostles. A recent discovery of me is the 12 paladins of France. These rather sort of exotic gallant knights who helped Charlemagne, a bit like the 12 knights around sort of Arthur. The 12 sibyls are a great one. The Romans lost their prophetic books And then they travel all around the world trying to find these sibyls who are female prophetesses of the ancient world and trying to rewrite this book that had burnt, this sort of advice, this secret spiritual advice sort of thing. And then you timed that up with the things that are much better known, like the 12 tribes of Israel, the 12 gods of Olympus, signs of the zodiac, 12 patriarchs. And then you get this sort of wonderful, almost like tracing paper, trying to get all these different shapes and see what might lie behind all of it.
And it's amazing that the contemporary power of numbers as well, because, you know, we referenced there in the introduction the number 13, and you still go down streets where there isn't a number 13 because, you know, the council feels it's unfair to make anybody live in a number 13. We're still scared of that number in many ways.
We are. I had an example the other day. I'm inviting people for dinner on Friday the 13th. My wife said, do you not want them to come? What was that about? If anyone's listening out there, I do want you to come.
But do you think that it's, you know, it's surprising how these numbers do disturb us? You know, and again, the 666 that we referred to, you know, people are cautious about it.
Quite rightly. I mean, the 13th is very, very old. And after I collected these things, you sort of began to sort of tease out what was the sort of magic of 13. And this wonderful sort of guru, now sadly dead, John Michel, great kiff-smoking character, used to lecture about platonic solids and the sort of harmony of the heavens, explained it to me that one of the first sort of miracles of science was just notching a bit of bone with the cycles of the moon. Counting that was very nearly 30. We now know it's 29 and a half, but visually it's 30. And that's still alive if you're a Muslim. You look for that first shape of the moon to begin your Ramadan fast. But there was that magic moment when they worked out that 12 of these sort of watchings of the moon fit almost exactly into the year of 360 days. And so that was that sort of fantastic thing where the sort of gears of spiritual life fitted together. These 12 moons fitted together into our solar year. And it was all fantastic. As we know, the Babylonians then decided the circle into 360. 16, 12 becomes the base of everything. But later on, with some more advanced sky watching, somewhere, you know, possibly about 8,000 BC, they found out this horrible thing is that 12 moons don't fit into the year. There's this missing 5 days. And this is the sort of origin of this stumpy little warped 13th month, which throughout human civilization was a time of terrible disorder. The spirits, the harmony of heavens was broken. And we know, you know, the Aztecs and the Mayans, they had blood sacrifices. The Egyptians did it in a more sort of, you know, musical sort of pageanty way. But all over the world, 13th was something to keep under control, keep under wraps, as it were. And with that, that's a magical thing about the 12 apostles. The 13th, of course, is Jesus, and he's marked out for sacrifice. The Balder, that wonderful heroic god of the Scandinavians, he's always accompanied by 12 heroic sort of warriors beside him, but he's the one who's going to get it first. So 13th, you know, if you got the 13th seat for thousands of years of human history, you know things were going to end up pretty badly for you.
It's amazing to think of the sort of the depth and the length and the duration through history of this, the kind of appeal of these stories. I just wonder, though, do you sometimes almost regret it because there seems to then be meaning in every number, you know, the number of a house or your bus. Do you sometimes almost think, I know too much, I can't take the 27 because not on this day of all days. Does it almost happen like that?
Well, it's definitely becoming obsessive. I mean, it's been a sort of 30-year project that I tidied up in 3 months. It's, you know, both quick and large. But as I've done it, and more the talks, people keep sort of feeding in sort of numbers. I habitually get the 19 bus. And then someone told me that the Quran has been put into this computer, partly funded by the scientists, and they found out there's a 19 numerical base to the surah. You know, and thought, wow. And then the man who found this out then got assassinated because someone thought he was becoming a little impious. And then I was chillingly found out that his murder was only apprehended the 19th year after his murder. And then you start, you know, getting a little shiver down your spine and becoming a fellow obsessive.
and definitely going by bike instead on those days.
Yeah.
Because it's interesting, I guess, that when we look at nature, we always think it's a random thing. But in fact, so many of the things we think are random are actually underpinned by numbers. You were talking about, you know, how we look at a dome or something. You forget that many of the natural occurrences of things as well, you know, leaves and animals and cells and how these, there is a kind of a mathematics behind it all.
There is. I mean, I'm not the one to answer that question. I'm more interested about how we get into our maths. You know, that wonderful example, this Arab shepherd took me around the Tunisian frontier, you know, when I was trying to do a guidebook, and he would hold out his good hand, his right hand, and say, these are the five rules of being a Muslim. You know, you pray, you fast, and this, that, and the other. And hold out the left hand, the bad hand, and say, these are the five things we should avoid: alcohol, pork, adultery, divination, you know, profaning the name of God. And I love that sort of aspect, is that it's a sort of innate numerology. and then all the number systems of the world are based on this sort of two hands of 10, and then you can go really into advanced maths, as far as I can go, is then add your toes and make a numerical basis of 20.
And tell me, do you have a favourite number?
Well, you mentioned 108, because it's recent knowledge. You always get excited about something new, and you mentioned about Genghis Khan's towers. And I can remember being told by one of our interns, a publishing company, about this only a couple of months ago. And now I see 108 everywhere. You know, at the end of the Japanese New Year, they ring out 108 bells. As a Zen priest has got 108 little things on his rosary. And then you find this sort of 108 underwrites the Indian imagination of eternity, of 432,000 million years being just a day in the life of Lord Brahma. And you find that unit everywhere. And then you go and listen to Krishna, you know, devotees singing, and they're reeling out a sort of a litany of 108 names of Krishna, you know, the black-faced god, the singer, the enchanters, you know, of the shepherdesses. And yes, I'm pretty keen on 108.
108 wouldn't be bad if that was to represent, for example, years on the planet, would it? 108, a fairly ripe old age to go for.
You'd have lasted quite a long time as well.
Yeah, tie in with Krishna.
And what about these the stories you mentioned, the slightly kind of macabre, the 19, an uncanny kind of... Is there one in particular that does fill you with dread? I mean, are you one of these people who sort of, you know, won't alight on the 13th floor of when you're in an elevator or anything like that? Or do you try and separate your day-to-day work from this sort of obsession that you have?
My stepmother-in-law will only enter an aeroplane on the 33rd step on her right foot. And she said it's a problem, you know, and I have to sort of shuffle and do this sort of balletic entrance. But none of this has really entered my life. But I am very keen on what other people get, and that sort of shake off, you know, the whole twist of the numerology that we've been talking a little bit is when you go to China and they're very keen on this sort of sounding like. So 9 is long, sounds like long lasting in Chinese. And so that's very, very good. 8 is wealth. So 88 is a great number to be on an 88 apartment or number 88 in a street. 4 sounds a little bit like death, so they avoid everything to do with that. But they like number 49, so they express it with 7 times 7. And that's all very curious, just sort of seeing what other people are coming from with their little numerical system. But actually, I've done the long answer. I should be spotting what the number that still chills me. And I think you mentioned that in the intro about 666, the mark of the beast. And that's rather fabulous, because it's a good lucky number in China. It's the addition of all the numbers on the roulette wheel. And it's the addition of all the, when you write out those, you know, Roman, Latin numerical systems, M, you know, C, L, V, that comes to 666. And we know it's, you know, obsessively in everybody's imagination, kind of St. John's revelations as being the mark of the beast. And that enters into another quirky, mad, mad world called Gematria, where you give numerical values to the letters of the alphabet. And so you can have this totally innocuous sentence which gets deconstructed into a numerical system. And that's what we think St. John was after, trying to label Nero Caesar as the person who'd desecrated the Temple of Jerusalem, begun the persecutions of the Christians. Other people using another Gematrian system think it's our Lord Jesus Christ. And there's a lot of room for quirky, obsessional stuff within 666.
Amazingly, at the end of the book, you go from million to zero. And at the very end, you alight on zero at the end. It says the Western world only came across this concept extraordinarily late. It says Phoenician merchants stumbled across it and brought it back to their homeland, where it was known as Zephyro, later corrupted to zero. Can you imagine the poor, you know, explorers coming back? What did you bring? I brought a giraffe. What did you bring? I brought a load of gold. What did you bring? I've got this little thing in a box. It's going to surprise you when I show it. But it's lasted longer than the giraffe, probably, in Venice, anyway.
Yeah, no, Zero's a good one. At the same time, I love the packs of cards, which seem to have come out of a Chinese courtesan's game and got really developed in Mamluk Egypt. And the same sort of Venetian trade route brought the cards with them, which have link in, without this proving myself too obsessional, about the four castes of society. So you can decode diamonds, hearts, spades into a system of caste. You can also add up all the numerical values of the cards. If you give Jack 11, Queen 12, King to make 364, and you add the Joker, and you make the days of the year. So you can use it as a sort of form of horoscope as well. The pack of cards expands into another whole numerical universe of symbolism.
And that's just a little glimpse into that amazing universe, which is described in fascinating detail in Barnaby Rogerson's book of numbers. I think highly worth picking up for the numerate and
that's
the
That's going to be on lots of
alike.
Sofas curled up with people on Christmas Day, I think.
Very much so. Barnaby Rogerson, thanks very much for coming in to tell us all about it here on the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Architecture is a powerful way to brand a place, but not without risk in a location rich in tradition and natural beauty. Monocle Films journeyed to the remote island of Fogo in Newfoundland to experience Todd Saunders' iconic artist studios and Travellers Inn.
Architecture is a tool, it's a language, and if done well, it can be a servant of place and people. And I think Todd does that. The studios are like little punctuation marks on the landscape that hold your attention. And a focus like that is a kind of a devotion, really, to the landscape.
Cultural resilience through architecture, now playing in the film's menu on monocle.com.
With the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards and Andrew Tuck. Now, they've been ridiculed through the generations, called names like Agent Orange, Carrot Head, even Ginger Nuts at times. Red-haired people, or gingers, as they're more commonly known, certainly here in the UK, haven't had the easiest of rides and are often the butt of jokes. Only roughly 1-2% of the population is born with ginger locks. And the generalisation is that they carry with them sharp personalities and sometimes even sharper tempers.
Well, in the Middle Ages, our red-haired counterparts were thought to be either witches or those in society that were deemed a little too sexed up. Fast forward to today, and while things are a little more kinder to redheads, they still carry with them a stigma one way or another. Well, a new exhibition hopes to unravel some of those age-old stereotypes and rebrand redheads as sexy, particularly red-headed men. Titled Red Hot, we're delighted to say that the man behind that exhibition joins us in the studio, Thomas Knights.
Hello.
Thomas, first of all, I was a bit disappointed. You've got brown hair, but red beard.
Oh, you know,
you're a bit of a fake.
Yeah, I'm a fake. I swear I was ginger. I look like those guys once. No, I don't know what happened. It's definitely got darker, but I actually think I willed it darker.
Okay.
I think I genuinely think I just begged and hoped it would get darker because I hated it so much growing up. My mum's earliest story of me was she took us all to see The Little Mermaid, and I cried the entire way home because I just was saying, apparently, I wish I had hair like the prince.
I thought you were going to say like the mermaid. I thought I had the mermaid, yes.
No.
Now, just before I let Tom in, let's just get the serious bit out of the way. It's backed by the Anti-Bullying Alliance, this exhibition. Well, that's not the whole reason you've done it. So, first of all, were you bullied as a kid for having red hair?
I was, yeah. But then actually, having done this exhibition, I've kind of learned that I didn't have it that bad. So some of the stories I've had have been quite interesting, to say the least. Like, you know, I mean, and there's been a recent case of this whole Kicker Ginger Day that is spurned from the South Park episode that they did years ago, and has now become an actual thing, and it's travelling the world. It started in Canada, and it happened in the UK, and a few kids were hospitalised on the way to school. You know, it's like, you think if that was about race, then that wouldn't ever be allowed to happen. You know, it's sort of, because it's ginger, it's seemingly okay, and I really do feel it's our last hurdle in racism. It is actually a form of racism. I stand by that comment. It's not taken as seriously because it's hair colour and it's, you know, deemed as, oh, you can dye it, you know. But the impact it has for the people involved in sort of receiving comments, it actually goes deep-rooted. And some of the people I've had, including myself, actually, I dyed my hair as soon as I could. As soon as I left school, dyed my hair blonde, 10 years, you know. And then one day I was just like, oh, God, I can't be bothered anymore. And then it grew out brown. So I was like, yes!
So you shouldn't have been worrying in the first place. I just wonder, is there a sort of a bit of a brotherhood then? Did you, once you...
I mean, no.
Is there not a sort of a good, strong, you know, a filial bond? And when you meet other gingers that you can all sort of rally together? Or does it not, never work like that?
Well, I don't know at school. I don't know whether it happened at school. At my school, there was a particularly ginger kid in my year who got the brunt of the ginger bullying. So actually, that's why I think I was sort of let off a bit, because, you know, I was just auburn, you know, that kind of Julia Roberts hair colour, that sort of beautiful auburn colour that's now gone brown. But
But he had sort of neon orange. I mean, we're talking sort of highlighter pen orange with eyelashes, eyebrows, everything. You know, he took the brunt of that whole in my year. And actually, for me, it was interesting because there was a kid. I went to an all boys rugby school, and there was a kid who was, well, sorry, he was a prefect when I joined when I was a kid, and he was the captain of the rugby team, and he had ginger hair, and I always thought, you know, and he was really popular with the girls, because we had girls in the sixth form, you know, so I kind of thought, well, actually, God, you know, maybe there is the option there, and maybe it's not so bad. But then, you know, he left, and there was just crap, you know, for then on in. But I think it's just accepted, you know, teachers don't take it as seriously. The Anti-Bullying Alliance were really thrilled when I approached them about this, because it is a genuine big issue and it hasn't been given really any attention. And but for me, the whole point of this exhibition is just because it's about is all about guys, because girls have their fair share of bullying at school, but they also have so many positive role models in popular culture to aspire towards, and the equivalent literally does not exist for boys. They are emasculated and desexualized, and any character played on TV or film is highlighted their insignificance or their weakness by also making them ginger, you know. And then, you know, people say like, oh, you know, the Weasleys in Harry Potter, but actually they were a very friendly family, but they weren't the strongest of families.
What about Damian Lewis?
Damian Lewis, this is it. It's all changed.
His hair off in series four.
Yeah. But this is why this exhibition, luckily for me, is very timely, because there is definitely a change happening, and it's definitely down to Prince Harry. Prince Harry and Damian Lewis have spearheaded the cool ginger thing. And now it's sort of deemed as a kind of...
That's a very red spearhead.
Yeah. I would love to shoot both of them for the exhibition. So if they're listening, if they happen to be listening, I get in touch.
But is Prince Harry, I mean, he certainly ginger. But
huge impact Prince Harry
but
has had.
But is he a positive role model? Because, yeah. I mean, his more, what shall we describe him as, cretinous behaviours, isn't it? Doesn't
brilliant,
he let the brilliant. Side down?
No, 100% not. He is the funny, naughty, cool prince. He's not allowed to, but he seems to do very well at sort of, you know, getting himself into little kind of media problems where he's naked. And I think that that's done wonders for the whole ginger male, because it's made it sexy. A lot of girls fancy Prince Harry and guys, you know, I mean, but what's important is that there is a kind of a sexy, good-looking ginger role model. It doesn't matter what he gets up to, and it's just brilliant that he's also a prince.
And then miraculously, there's Eddie Redmayne.
Redmayne.
That's uncanny, isn't it?
But this is a great example.
And you've got your exhibition on Red Church Street.
It's all serendipity. Eddie Redmayne is an interesting one. I've been trying to get hold of him for the exhibition, but he doesn't class himself as redheaded anymore. He was like a redheaded young Brit theatre actor.
Then,
soon as
then
you go to
sneakily
Hollywood,
went brown like you.
It goes brown. And I don't know whether it's
did you
like
go to Hollywood?
This is actually a genuine question I have. You know, I'm thinking about Damian Lewis and thinking, when these people get successful, they go to Hollywood, do their agents say, listen, you're going to get a lot more work. It's going to be a lot easier for us to sell you if we dye your hair and we just slowly, like, you know, Ewan McGregor is another example of someone who's gone that way. You know, and Michael Fassbender, or however you say his name. And, you know, there are countless numbers of actors.
Fassbender, I think, probably. Less of the bender, more of the binder.
Fassbender. it's an interesting guy. And I would love to talk to Damian Lewis about the whole Homeland things. I think, you know, when he won that role, you wonder whether there was a conversation between him and his agent and the producers saying, right, Damien, listen, so you're gonna definitely play the lead, but we just got to talk about your red hair. Or not. Maybe there wasn't
a
conversation.
Was it a more insidious thing where actually they, you know, it was typecast and they were like, we want a bit of mystery. Is he rotten to the core, yeah, ultimately? Let's bag ourselves a ginger.
But that's it. I mean, and also, you know, he is the first red-headed male to play a lead role in Hollywood ever. In TV show, and people are going to dispute this, but there are so few examples of leading men in Hollywood with red hair. So he is really an anomaly.
Tell us historically, why did this all happen? Was it just difference?
Well, apparently I've done a bit of
research. Because Henry VIII had red hair,
yeah,
didn't he?
It used to be a very noble, very strong hair colour, at some point in history, it all changed. And apparently, I don't want to upset anyone here, but apparently there was a war we had at one point with the Scottish, and our English anger to the Scottish was directed at the red hair. And it's a hangover from that, apparently. The whole sort of anti-red hair thing is a hangover from some previous war. I don't know whether there's any truth in that, but that's what I've gained from some probably really very dodgy internet research. But it's seemingly deeply ingrained in our culture that it's permeates so many things, you know, and especially with women. I'm really interested with women's attitudes towards ginger men because, you know, I shot Greg Rutherford for it and his girlfriend told me that her friends all said to
this
her,
is the British athlete, for people who don't know.
Yeah, the, you know, won gold at the London Olympics for long jumping. He's a brilliant guy, very good looking ginger guy. He sort of says, you know, I'm termed the ginger athlete, you know. That's what he's coined, you know. So it's a weird sort of stigma he carries. Anyway, but his girlfriend said that, you know, when she started dating him, all her friends said, God, I didn't realise you had a thing for gingers. And it's sort of, you know, as a girl, it's a tricky thing. Yeah. And you get, they're kind of not proud of who, I wasn't proud of who I was. I was so, so ashamed of being ginger. Well, Thomas, I hated it.
We're beginning to get the feeling that the redheads can talk a bit anyway.
Yeah, I did tell you. I'm
exactly.
Sorry.
That's one cultural disadvantage they've come without. But it's a strike back in the name of redheads everywhere. It's called Red Hot. And that's the voice of Thomas Knights, who's one of the people who's made it all happen. Thomas, thanks very much for coming to speak to us about it
on
the Monocle Weekly.
Much.
That is all for this edition, 228 no less, of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show is produced by Phil Hahn. Our studio manager was Jack Phillips. Did you enjoy today's show, Andrew? What did you think? What was the highlight for you? Numbers? Red hair?
I just thought it was a learning curve. I've got, you know, a richer vocabulary after today. I now know what platonic solids are. You don't have to take a pill for that. And I've also been to a fire crotch sale. So that was, all in all, it's been a bit of an achievement today.
It was a lesson. It was a lesson in life all around the world here on the Monocle Weekly, and very enjoyable it was too. But that, I'm afraid, is all for this week's programme. So from me, Tom Edwards.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
That is all. Goodbye.